Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. If you are looking for something new to listen to, there are lots of other NPR podcasts, including great interviews, highlights from the week's news, storytelling, and entertainment. Browse them all on iTunes under podcasts. The kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll celebrate the end of summer by looking back at what we'll take away from the season's good stuff. Then we'll turn our attention to the fall and get into what we're looking forward to and not in the months to come. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, here at the Bell House in Brooklyn.
You know, the best part is that took so long, we don't even have to do a show. Good night, everybody!
Hey, I am all about cheering for a bar. Let's go across the group here. Mike Katzef.
Hello.
Now, Mike, as many of you know, was the original producer of our show. That is why he is our producer emeritus. What do you do now, Mike?
I'm a producer at Soundcheck at WNYC. I take photography and I do writing. And we have bands in the studio all the time, and it's really awesome.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I pause for applause.
You can't actually do that.
I'm a writer and editor with NPR Music.
You know, when we were talking about topics for this show, we tend to move seasonally. We talk a lot about, you know, we enter the summer, we enter the fall, we get to the end of the year, and this seemed like a good time to transition kind of from this summer into this fall. So we were going to start by taking a little bit of a look back at the stuff that we really enjoyed this summer. You want to kick us off, Stephen?
The first thing that stood out for me looking back on the summer, in entertainment specifically, not just the summer in general, is that we had better blockbusters.
Yeah.
We just had, like, last summer was, it is not working in the mines doing this.
No.
So, like, I had to see Man of Steel and I hated it. My life is the worst.
You did hate Man of Steel, though.
I really hated Man of Steel so
really
much.
Hated Man of Steel.
It's amazing. I have like a 5-second long memory. So if the last movie I saw was a good movie, I'm like, movies are great.
Yeah.
And it just felt like the big blockbustery movies were better. Even though it's based on a Marvel comic, you finally had a big blockbustery action movie in which nobody really knew any of the characters. It wasn't really based on a known franchise. It wasn't anything that people, you know, were coming in with all these expectations on. And it was, I'm talking about Guardians of the Galaxy.
I was just going to ask if you were going to, like, if it was suspense.
And of course I'm talking about the dawn of the planet of the... In general, like, even the movies that I thankfully didn't have to see, I've heard were better. I mean, people like the X-Men. You liked the X-Men.
I did very much.
People like that thing I didn't see.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, I mean, Captain America Winter Soldier, even though I was not fully on board with that movie the way most people were, was a very, very stylishly made film.
Right.
Edge of Tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yes. Great movie. Edge of Tomorrow.
Yeah. which now has another stupid title.
Yeah.
Because it's now being called Live, Die, Repeat. Is
yeah.
that
yeah.
right?
Yeah. Yeah, for the DVD / VOD.
It is an action movie with Tom Cruise, and I liked it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Way better than it should have been.
You know, just in general, it felt, I think I said this maybe at a, I think it might have even been a live show last year, that like last year, the first 9 months of the year, at least into August, felt a little dire, and then all of a sudden it was like, 12 Years a Slave, movies are great!
Yeah. Like, coming out of Toronto, that often happens, because people come back from the Toronto International Film Festival really excited about stuff, and I think that definitely happened last year. That's where, you know, people first saw Gravity and were excited about Gravity, but up until then, it had kind of been that Man of Steely Summer.
Yeah, and this year, just in general, like the Lego Movie was good.
Right.
Like, that's obviously not a summer project.
Well, but it's
in
summer-y.
General, this felt like an unusually strong year for movies, and this summer in particular was not what I had dreaded in the least.
Yeah. How about you, Glenn? Did you enjoy the summer of movies?
I agree. And I was trying to figure out what's different. It does seem like the writer is at the forefront a little bit more this year. You get more jokes. I'm always a fan of more jokes.
Yeah.
It seems that there's less pronouncements, less stentorian, less grave, less gravity, because there was no gravity this year.
See what you did there.
There's a lighter touch this season, and I think that's a good direction for us to be going in. Yeah. With Ant-Man coming out next year, it's a great direction.
Yeah. I mean, this was one of the better years I can remember for all of that stuff. And I don't know, I mean, it feels reactionary to last summer, but I don't know if it is, because all these are probably all being made at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it seemed like movies were remembered to be a little fun this year in a way that...
It did.
And I think that extends like even beyond blockbusters. It seems like a lot of the counter-programming stuff was really strong as well. There were a lot of options this summer that if you didn't want to see a big exploding movie, you could see They Came Together, you could see Boyhood, you could see Obvious Child, which I think is like, you know, a romantic comedy, but in a very real way. I thought all of those really worked.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked a bit about Boyhood. We didn't talk very much about the other ones that you mentioned. I did see They Came Together, and even though I didn't love it, it was hard for me to get a handle on the spoofy tone. I wasn't sure it was working quite the way they wanted.
It didn't go far enough.
Yeah, that was weird, some of it just was not a good. Some of it was just a bad romantic comedy, as opposed to being like a. Some of it was a little too literal to me. Yeah. It felt a lot like a bad version of that movie instead of feeling like it was making jokes about a bad version of that movie.
I would still take that over the real version of that movie. Well, that's 100 times. Like, I would still see, even if it was just a Paul Rudd, Amy Poehler rom-com, that would be great. But they took like an extra. At least took the effort to make an extra level of that.
Right.
Yeah. For
sure. Right. How about you, Glenn? What struck you about this summer?
For me, it was really the summer of John Oliver's Last Week Tonight. I was excited about this show because I loved his work on The Daily Show. Like, this time last year, we were all talking about how great John Oliver was on The Daily Show. I'm also a huge fan of The Bugle, the podcast he does with Andy Zaltzman. Okay, so those people who clapped, you know The Bugle. You know that it is very British. They're doing the hyper-literate circumlocution. They're doing the penis jokes. It's a very silly show, but it is very sharp and cutting. So I was trying to figure out how it would fit on HBO, for example. And I was wondering whether we still need another fake news show that is commenting, critiquing how American television news covers a story. Right. And in fact, when the first show aired, that's pretty much what a lot of the write-ups said. This is The Daily Show. They were very wrong, but it took a while to see exactly how different the show is because their critique of American television news is a lot more oblique. For example, so like last week when there's a horrible news week, they can bust out a 15 minutes on a really great piece about the militarization of local police. But on weeks when there's nothing dominating the news to that extent, they criticize American television news by covering stories for 15 minutes at a time that American television news doesn't touch. Yeah. Exactly. So what have they done? They've done the Indian election, FIFA corruption, capital punishment, net neutrality, income inequality, native advertising, payday loans, immigration reform, Argentinian debt restructuring, bitch. Yeah. 10 minutes on Argentinian debt restructuring.
If I hear one more comedy routine about Argentinian debt restructuring, though.
But and it's all enlivened by the jokes. Oliver is coming at it with a very British, whatever the British equivalent of outrage is. I don't think they have it. Peak, maybe, coming out with a peak. Or umbrage, I don't know. But and you can find these topics covered on American. You can, like, if you go to the NewsHour, if you go to 60 Minutes, you're going to find some of this stuff covered. But I love that we now have a show where, very frankly, he can't hide behind things like Stewart hides behind by saying, oh, we're just jokes.
Yeah.
Oh, we're not. Don't take us too seriously. There's an earnestness to the presentation, and the topics he's covering, they're covering, says there's something real at there. Right. So I just love that show.
Yeah, I don't feel like it's as reliant as The Daily Show sometimes is on sort of just showing the coverage and then kind of just standing there looking shocked. Yeah. I feel like there's a little bit more, which can be very effective itself, but I feel like there's a little more of an attempt to, as you're saying, kind of say the affirmative thing as opposed to just showing the thing and then mm-hmm. being appalled by it.
Also, having a week to prepare allows right. you to kind of push yeah. the story forward and move it rather than like, this is happening in real time. They have a week yeah. to kind of sit on it and see how it turns out.
We had a conversation in, yeah. in a show when Last Week Tonight was starting. One of the weeks that Audie Cornish was on our show, we talked to her about kind of the rhythm of news, and we talked a lot about the timing of a show like this and whether it'd be weird to have it a week later. And I think having that week has served them really well.
Well, it ends up being less instant reaction. So it's the way you would do a weekend news show where you have more reflection yeah. than reaction.
So for me, this was the summer of Roxane Gay. Roxane Gay is a writer who just has recently released an essay collection called Bad Feminist, which I just finished. She also has her first novel, An Untamed State, which Kat Chow talked about on our show recently. It came out in May. But she also writes with enormous humanity and humor on Twitter and Tumblr, and I think is, for me, a writer who has really advanced those forms and has explored what is possible with those forms in a way that I think has sort of benefited everybody who's writing in these kind of instant formats. She has a thing she does on Tumblr where when she's very angry about something, like a news story, she does these posts that I think are just amazing, where she cooks something, like people do when they cook and write about what they're cooking. They're recipe photos and talking about what she's doing and how she made the thing, but they're interspersed with pieces of essay writing about whatever she's angry about. And for me, I find that the juxtaposition of those things really brings home how painful these things are for her. A lot of times they have to do with racism or sexual violence, things like that. It sounds like the weirdest thing, but integrating them into this very everyday process of cooking, and it kind of gives you this sense that she's sort of talking and soothing herself. And I find it an enormously effective way to write. And there are things about her voice that aren't heard a whole lot. She's a woman of color. She's a queer woman. She's a big woman. She talks about all of those things a lot. I mean, a book called Bad Feminist is number 13 on a New York Times bestseller list. That's shocking. And if you read that book, it's like incredibly sophisticated and thoughtful and advances all kinds of discussions. And it's not the kind of thing where you read the essay collection and you think, well, this is a great essay collection because I agree with all of this, which is a great kind of essay collection to read. It can be. Sure. You're just turning every page like, yeah, yeah. Turn another page. Oh, yes, exactly. It's the feeling of like, it's that really pleasant friction of like a really intelligent person's mind kind of against your own mind and against your own thinking. And so for me, it's not just kind of a summer of just her individually, but a summer of kind of the growth of all of these mixed formats where you can be great on Twitter and also a novelist and a literary critic and an essayist and mm-hmm. stuff like that. So that's sort of where we are, I think, in terms of our summer. So then we were going to talk about looking ahead to the fall and what is to come. So this time, I'll start all the way down there with Mike. What's on your radar, buddy?
Sure. So there's a couple movies that look pretty amazing. One comes out in October. It's called Birdman. And it looks super bizarre. A trailer just went up, I think, relatively recently. It's Michael Keaton, Zach Galifianakis, Edward Norton, Emma Stone, Naomi Watts. It's directed, though, by Alejandro González Iñárritu, who also did Babel. He did Amores Perros, 21 Grams. This looks like more of a, I don't even say a comedy, per se, but it looks more absurdist. It looks yeah. surreal. And Michael Keaton plays a washed-up actor who at one point played an iconic superhero. That sounds familiar.
Digging deep.
Yeah.
Just kidding. I love Michael Keaton.
I do too. It's playing in that world, I think.
Sure.
In order to kind of like reclaim his life, he's staging this Broadway musical. That's the plot synopsis, basically. But from the imagery from the trailer, it just looks so surreal and bizarre, and it looks like there's fantasy sequences, and there's gigantic bird monsters, and there's washed up seals on a beach, and it looks like kind of like this surreal noir crime drama. I don't know. It looks amazing. It has great cast.
Yeah.
I have no idea what to expect because a lot of what Inarritu's other movies are pretty heavy subjects. Yeah. Babel is a very heavy subject. Right. Maurice Perros is emotionally devastating. I mean, they're all beautiful movies, but this just looks like a nice, interesting turn. So that's one. The other one is P.T. Anderson's Inherent Vice, which similarly plays like another sort of like crime and surrealism kind of playing together. This is based on a Thomas Pynchon novel that came out in 2009. Joaquin Phoenix is in it, Josh Brolin, Owen Wilson, and it's set in L.A. in the 1970s. And one thing that P.T. Anderson does a lot, he sets a lot of his movies on the West Coast, a lot of it in L.A., in different time periods. This just seems like another sort of iteration of that. The story is more or less Joaquin Phoenix looks like he's a kind of shaggy dog, pothead, gumshoe detective. Some sort of femme fatale woman comes into his life, embroils him in this mystery, this investigation, and he meets bizarro characters. And that's all kind of what I know about it at this point. I have not read the novel, but I give P.T. Anderson kind of a free pass. Like, I love everything he's ever put out.
What's your favorite?
Oh, man. Magnolia, probably?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's my favorite.
Yep.
Glenn, how about you? Fall look ahead.
If you showed 10-year-old Glenn this fall's television schedule, it would blow his mind. Monday, Gotham. Tuesday, The Flash and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Wednesday, Arrow. Thursday, nothing. You might as well go outside. Friday, Constantine. He would be like, awesome. And I'd be like, right, every comic you love. And he'd be like, are they any good? And I'd say, I've only seen two of them, and you know, there's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And he'd be like, oh, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., awesome. So Nick Fury. And I'd be like, Nick Fury isn't really on it. He's had a cameo mid-season, but Patton Oswalt's on it, and he's very funny. And I think he's going to be, you know, almost a semi-regular next season. And he'd say, who's Patton Oswalt? And I would say, well, and he would say, what about Arrow? And I would say, the shirtless training montages are spot on. And he would say, ooh, gay. And I would say, shut up. And he would say, what? And I'd say, tick, tick, tick. And he'd say, hey. But then we would share a look of understanding that we would not comment upon. And then he'd say, what happened to our hair? And I'd be like, poof. So I've only seen two of them. So Linda, you've seen Gotham, you've seen The Flash, and you've seen...
I just have to pause. That just made my day. But...
So Gotham looks like Nolan exploded all over it and left everybody feeling very glum.
Yep.
Constantine looks dumb but fun, and The Flash, like everything I read about this thing, seems like this is like the Goldilocks show, where they understand that it's supposed to be fun. They're all kind of on the same page with, we want to do a lighter tone, which actually fits the character really well. So what do you think of these?
I've seen all three of the new ones. Gotham is the gray, as we have said on the show, Nolan-y, very influenced by not just the tone of Nolan, but like that look, like the that very kind of washed, to me, washed out.
Very dour.
Look. Did not impress me that much. It's looking at Jim Gordon when he's a young cop, before there is a Batman. So my problem with Gotham is it's kind of built around this conflict of like, will he be able to solve this without a bat type of man?
Nope. Turns out, no.
No, he won't. I have trouble with the central conceit of it.
Well, the central conceit, of course, is like the Smallville central conceit, which is like, we'll give you season after season of milk, flour, and eggs. And in the very last episode, for 30 seconds, you're going to see cake.
Well, yeah.
A little glimpse of cake.
But this to me is like, if you're going to make your show like one man against crime, you have to give me at least some possibility that the man might beat the crime.
Yeah.
And you know he's not going to. As long as like Bruce Wayne is still walking around and he's a little tiny kid, you're like, well, you're going to lose this week, buddy.
Yeah.
Sorry, Jim Gordon, it's not happening. So that one is not to my taste.
Constantine?
The thing about Constantine, and this is kind of what has been going around about Constantine. I mean, I have been told it's pretty faithful to the comic in some ways. Although, first of all, as I'm told, he smokes like a chimney in the comic. On TV, you can't show very much smoking. So he's always, like, putting out cigarettes.
Like he had just smoked.
And it just becomes kind of goofy. You're seeing a guy, like, every time you cut to him, he's like...
Yeah. Boy, I should really stop smoking soon.
Every time he's putting it out.
Are they allowed to vape?
Yeah.
The other thing about Constantine in the comics is that he has been established later in the run, as I understand it, after quite a couple of decades, but was established as bisexual, which they are not doing on the show. And when asked about it, they were like, well, he became bisexual 20 years into the comics, so maybe in 20 years. And everybody was like, oh, hilarious.
All right.
Hilarious.
And The Flash?
I liked The Flash a lot. The Flash is up my alley. I am, with my superhero movies, I like them to be a little bit funny, fun, goofy.
Right.
But still, you know, still have a good heart. I liked The Flash.
Okay, here's how you improve all of these shows in one fell swoop. Very quickly. You just give the writer's room this edict. No abstract nouns. Okay, hear me out. Writers of these shows feel like they need to match the larger-than-life events with larger-than-life portentous and portentous and pretentious dialogue. But one of the reasons I love the Thrilling Adventure Hour so much is because they understand that, yes, that amid...
You're just pandering.
I am. Amid all these larger-than-life things, people are still people. They still talk like normal human beings. And as soon as you start getting an abstract noun in there, everything just feels like you're pressing down on it. So don't say good, don't say evil, don't say justice, don't say power especially. Don't say crime, don't say corruption, and this is going to be tough for Gotham, but don't say this city. This city needs me. No, it doesn't. People
Can I say
need
we built
you.
This city?
Yeah, that's right. You may say they built the city.
Yeah, I think they say the city a bunch of times.
Of course they
do. Probably. And, you know, it's like the city's a character.
Oh, yeah.
How about you, Stephen Thompson?
All right, I went with a movie and a TV show. And movie-wise, I looked a little ways ahead to a movie called Big Eyes, directed by... Look at that. Just woo! directed by Tim Burton, who is a very mixed bag as a filmmaker. But my favorite Tim Burton movie is Ed Wood. And it brings out his fascination with kind of outsider artists and obsessives, and I just a world that fascinates me. And Big Eyes is about a husband and wife team, Walter Keane and Margaret Keane, and their involvement in the paintings of the children with the gigantic sad eyes.
Oh.
And the story is basically Walter Keane's involvement in these paintings was he signed his name to them. And her involvement was that she painted them.
Yeah, well, it's a give and take.
And so the movie is based on how this affects their relationship. Not well.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's a lower budget movie. It's not Tim Burton with $200 million to flush away.
Right.
It just looks like a smaller, odder movie. So that's kind of the yes.
Is Helena Bonham Carter anywhere in the?
I did not see her in the top line cast. She probably
probably shows up
somewhere with the big eyes.
Yeah.
She plays a painting.
There's lots of paintings of Helena Bonham Carter.
She'd play a painting. Great.
I think that's the way to do that. The TV show, this just fascinated me. Linda, you came back from the Television Critics Association press tour and, you know, having seen a bunch of shows, and one of the shows that you really liked was called Marry Me.
Okay.
It premieres NBC Tuesday, October 14th. I've got the description here, and this is what fascinated me. This is the description of the show that Linda loves. You love the show, right?
I like it. I like it about as much as I ever like network comedy pilots, which is to say, promising.
Right.
Promising.
Yeah. And that's really all you can hope for
from
a comedy pilot.
I want you to tag me with, like, go marry this show if you like it so much.
So it's from David Caspi, who did Happy Endings. Yeah. Promising, right? So why you have to be so careful when you decide whether to watch a show? Listen to this. Happy Endings. David Caspi is the writer behind this rom-com about a couple who are well on their way to tying the knot. There's just one problem. They can't get the marriage proposal right. Is it a sign that they aren't supposed to be together? Or do they just need to stop screwing up their overly inventive attempts to get engaged? That is the dumbest idea for a show. You know the notion, the concept of the idiot plot? You know, Roger Ebert used to talk about this all the time, where, like, the movie would be resolved in 5 minutes if everybody involved wasn't stupid. The central concept of the show, based on that description, you can resolve that issue in 1 second. I decided before I remembered that it was one of the shows that you liked that I was
that anyone who liked this would be a moron.
that I was going to watch it just to see how they could possibly stretch that incredibly stupid idea for one episode. But obviously, it gets better. Correct.
First of all, you have to understand that the couple in this show is played by Casey Wilson, who is also in Happy Endings, the great and good Casey Wilson, and Ken Marino. So you're starting with a very strong cast, and you're starting with a cast that can kind of play into quirk. And what you have to remember, this is kind of like the quiz that we did about the upfront marketing proposals that we did earlier in the year. You have to remember, like, an incredibly uncreative person wrote that, right? Like, the person who wrote that has the job of writing that because they're not writing a show. I mean, that's... Like, the people who are responsible for stuff like that are not the same people who are responsible for giving the show. Like, you know what Cheers would sound like in a row? It'd be like, a bunch of drunks hang around at a bar. Can this sexy pitcher make a play for the prim waitress? Like, it would sound stupid. You can make anything sound stupid. Right. You can make anything sound stupid. And they usually do. So, I mean, you know, David Caspi, who did Happy Endings and is doing this show, has a very specific sensibility. The thing I like about it is that it has that specificity of sensibility. There are people who watch, there are other critics, don't get me wrong, there are critics who watch this show and are like, nope, no way. And who would tell you that you're exactly right about it. Well, it's good. Just a matter of...
I'm just going to listen to them.
Yeah, I'll hook you up with them. Though?
So that's clearly about the pilot.
Yeah.
How does that sustain for a season if it gets picked up? How does it get second season?
It doesn't.
What is the show actually about once you get beyond, like, the high concept? Like, so many of these sitcoms have, like, a massively high concept that is like, that should just be a two-hour movie and be done. A 90-minute movie.
Right. And you have to...
Or a 30-minute movie.
A 30-minute movie.
Yeah.
I mean,
a quick proposal, it doesn't take long.
You have to assume that it would. You have to assume that it would be a show about the couple, and that if it didn't successfully become a show about the couple, it wouldn't work. But there are certain ones that you look at and you just think, NBC has this show A to Z, which stars, as I have been saying, the mother and the nipple guy from Mad Men. And what they are building this around is, see, it's A to Z, and so every episode is like, A is for... And then it's something that starts with A, and that's the episode, which strikes me as self-defeating, dumb, boring, and the kind of thing that makes people go, that could be a show. Like, so you have to hope that it doesn't really turn out to be about that. And Marry Me is the same way. What I wanted to, and I feel like now I should be like, that's mine too. I just briefly wanted to mention the two movies that I'm kind of excited about because the expectations are really high, but I'm somewhat optimistic anyway, which are, surprisingly enough, given the conversation we had earlier, Interstellar, the Christopher Nolan movie. I have a way of picking on Christopher Nolan for being very Christopher Nolan-y, but I did love Memento, and I think he's an incredibly smart guy, and I think he's a guy who does try interesting things. Anytime that things are made under, like, a veil of secrecy, I often wind up feeling like they shouldn't do that. Like, they should not raise expectations so much. But I'm excited to see what this is. It has an amazing cast, not just the ever-present Matthew McConaughey, but but Jessica Chastain and Anne Hathaway. And I would love Anne Hathaway to be great so that people can stop being total asses to Anne Hathaway. So that's the first one. Yeah. So that's...
Suck it, haters.
That's the first one. That's the first one. And the other one is Gone Girl, which I am really excited about. We talked about this book a number of times on the show. It is now, like, sort of such a popular... It became such a popular thing that now it's hard to talk about the fact that you actually really did like it. I really did love it. It strikes me as an absolutely impossible book to adapt, which is why I'm really excited about the fact that they're adapting it. I like it when Ben Affleck, just like Hugh Grant, I like it when he plays into his underlying smarminess, which if you saw, like, there was a movie, State of Play, where he also plays a guy who has this, like, underlying, like, slick of gross. And I think there's some of that in this role potentially for him. David Fincher, who's directing, is again a really interesting creative person who I don't love everything that he does, but he's made some incredibly fascinating stuff. So I'm excited about both of those movies.
Excellent.
And that brings us to our final segment, what is making us happy this week? Mike Katzoff, what is making you happy this week, sir?
I'm happy I don't have to edit this show when we're done.
Yeah.
I can actually just go home. What's actually making me happy is there's a new book from Brian Lee O'Malley. Mm-hmm. Brian Lee O'Malley, if you don't know who he is, he did the Scott Pilgrim series, which a lot of people remember, the Scott Pilgrim vs. the World movie with Michael Cera. A very underrated action movie that, you know, and the books too, that kind of brought in together like this world of video games and anime and kind of being in transition in your 20s and growing up. So his new book is called Seconds. It's been 4 or 5 years since the last Scott Pilgrim book. And I think this book sort of like picks up how old a Scott Pilgrim kind of character would be 5 years later. The character is named Katie. She works in a restaurant and is very successful, but kind of like itching for something new. And she's like 29 years old and kind of like paying off like the stagnation of being kind of an adult. You've made your choices and now you're like, I'm stuck in this world. How do I kind of reinvent myself? While Scott Pilgrim was very inventive in like mixing all these genres together, this is like a more normal story in the way that a normal story where a fairy shows up and offers you sort of the chance to change something by giving you a mushroom, by giving you a pad of paper where you write your regret on it. You take the mushroom, you eat it, you go to sleep, and like whatever that regret is sort of changed. So as the story kind of takes place, her life is sort of in a similar transition, and she, after like some sort of accident that happens, she wants to undo that thing. But you start to realize like how changing one little variable will connect all these strings to all these other things in her life. And as she kind of gets obsessed with like perfecting her life in every way, she keeps popping these mushrooms. And it becomes more bizarre and a little surreal. Kind of like sliding doors where you can see like two kind of tangents. You kind of like relive the moment, but seeing it slightly differently. Ultimately, it's sort of a story about like second chances and reinvention and weird skeleton creatures that eventually start showing up as this world becomes more and more mutated by changing it. It's very fantastical and bizarre and weird, but it's very heartfelt at the same time. It's really funny, and it's really nice to having like this author back.
Right.
Give the name again.
Seconds by Brian Lee O'Malley.
Thank you very much, Mike Gatza. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, sir?
Lila is a new novel by Marilyn Robinson. Doesn't come out until October 7th, but I have already read it. It's the third book set in Gilead, Iowa. First one was Gilead, won the Pulitzer. Home was the second. And I'm going to admit it here, I'm the jerk who didn't get those books. Now, understand that Housekeeping, her first novel, is probably my favorite book, my favorite novel ever. That sentence by sentence, that book is just inspiring. I found those books, Gilead and Home, inspirational. There's a difference there. It's just for reasons that have more to do with me, the questions at the core of these books, which are about a very specific kind of faith, very specific questions of spirituality, just didn't speak to me. I felt like I was reading the owner's manual to a car I will never own. And I just didn't work for me, which is why it surprised me so much that this third book, Lila, just knocked me for a loop, because there's something so wonderful about it. So the plot is basically that this characters recur throughout these three novels, and this is the story of a sort of itinerant worker woman who wanders into town of Gilead, Iowa, into a town that's kind of dominated by the life of the church. And she has been homeless all her life, and she's rough, I guess you would say. And what happens over the course of the novel is these two people, the preacher and her, slowly come to learn to trust one another and eventually get to know each other and then eventually fall in love. Such a tenderness to this book, but there is no preciousness, and that is very important to me. There is an astringency to the Lila character. There's a hardness there. She's filled with dread and doubt, and she refuses to trust anyone. And all she wants to do is be of use. And that's something I can kind of relate to. Dread and contempt. I'm in. And I wouldn't want to diagram this book because it just moves backwards and forwards in time. But you are never lost because you are just in the hands of a masterful writer. So that is Lila. Comes out October 7th by Marilyn Robinson.
Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
First of all, obviously, this wonderful crowd, this wonderful event. Thank you so much for being here. It's this is our first, well, we were at Comic-Con, but this is our first kind of public event outside of Washington, D.C., and it's just been intoxicating. Not yet literally. Meet us after for the meet and greet.
Soon.
And that may change. But yeah. But I think what I really found myself marveling at over and over again over the course of this past week is the incredible range of what social media can do. But Twitter, at least my Twitter feed, was just this cauldron of Ferguson rage. And of, in a way, storytelling of the way that all of the issues surrounding that series of events, how that has unfolded. And it has been this fascinating real-time exhibit where everybody has a window into something that they need to see. And, you know, yes, Twitter is for jokes, but it also...
For me.
But it also served this incredible, incredible purpose. And so my Twitter feed was Ferguson Rage over here. And my Facebook page was people getting doused with buckets of water.
Yeah.
Over and over and over again. My children did it and challenged me, so now I have to do it. The only people in the world that I wouldn't blow off. If they asked me to do it, so on one hand you have this incredible serious thing, but over here you're like, okay, I'm going to spend some time with the BuzzFeed list of 22 people who shouldn't have done the ice bucket challenge, which consists mostly of people getting conked on the head with buckets. and I'm a simple man of simple needs.
I mean, it's really satisfying to watch that.
Mike's like, forget it.
And so,
Mike's like, no, it's the best.
And so you learn things like if you're going to ever, douse yourself with a bucket of water, don't have somebody take a garbage can and lower it from the deck overhead, or the garbage can will inevitably, of course, slip out of the person's hands and bash you full on the top of the head.
Don't tip it off the deck.
Just have a bucket. Get a regular bucket. Bucket sales have got to be skyrocketing. I am so, what's making me happy this week is the fate of the bucket industry.
Booming. Booming. This is when your investment in bucket futures is really
big. Yeah, I've been riding the wave. Keep buying buckets, people. Anyway, so yeah, the incredible range, I guess, of conversation in America.
Wonderful. I did come up with a couple of small things. One of which is that we ran at NPR our pal Chris Klimek's review of The Expendables 3. And if you have not read Chris's review of The Expendables 3, it is sort of a beautiful celebration of something that he both is perfectly situated to make merciless fun of, and also, you can tell, kind of deeply loves. And it's a really fantastically evocative piece of playful writing, and I really, really, truly loved it. He has a wonderful moment where he just peaks. He just builds to this recognition that finally we have people who are giving the young, hungry action fans of America what they have wanted: more Kelsey Grammer. More like that in Chris's wonderful review of The Expendables 3. I went back and forth a lot about whether to mention this just because I don't want it to be confused with anything. It's actually making me happy. But Stephen mentioned the Ferguson stuff in his Twitter feed. And I did want to say that not making me happy, but certainly making me enormously proud right now, is that our very, very dear pal and PCHH family member, Gene Demby, is down there right now. And has been doing some fantastic and beautiful writing, did some fantastic and beautiful writing today. So always proud to know him, maybe a little extra proud to know him today for the quality of that work. And to turn on a really, like to pivot real hard, I've been making a tradition at these live shows of closing with a magazine. At our first one, it was Yikes magazine. At our last one, it was Tiger Beat, I think.
I believe it was Tiger Beat, yeah.
So today, I got my copy of Bop. And what I learned from this magazine is that I don't even know who these bands are.
They're jazz musicians, I thought. Yeah. I thought it was like Charlie Parker.
Yeah. I looked at it and I sort of said, I was backstage, I was saying, Vamps, is that a thing? Stephen Cousin, yeah. I said, Five, is that, what is that? And I don't know what any of the abbreviations are. Like, I know that 1D is One Direction, but that's the only one that I think I know on this entire front page of this magazine. So that means that what is making me happy this week is my mortality. As seen on the front cover of Bop. So that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. And you can follow Mike at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica _ Reedy, REEDY. And of course, as always, Mike's band Hello Come In provides our in and out music, which you will hear in just a little bit. So thanks to all of you guys for being here, and thanks to all of you guys. And we will see you back here next week.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. If you are looking for something new to listen to, there are lots of other NPR podcasts, including great interviews, highlights from the week's news, storytelling, and entertainment. Browse them all on iTunes under Podcasts.